You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Thomas Edison made huge news because it emerged that if anyone wanted to work for Edison's laboratory, they had to pass a test, which consisted of scientific and political and geographic questions that were devised by Edison. There were questions like, what's the percentage of magnetite in magnetite ore? How many states border Kentucky? And he said, these college kids today are stupid. They don't know anything. A reporter, a wise-ass reporter, comes to Einstein, who is visiting the United States at this time, and asks him, I guess what he calls an Edison test question, which is, what is the speed of sound? And he trips up the great Einstein. Einstein's response is a very forthright, I don't know. And then he explains, I'm not in the habit of memorizing such things. That's what I have books for.
So we're really pleased to have John Blackwell on today. He's the senior publishing editor for the Wall Street Journal. He's also worked with the Daily News and other places. The reason we're talking to him today is that he hosts This Day in 1921 on Twitter. So if you're on Twitter, he's at 100 Years Ago News. At 100 Years Ago News. What he's done is amazing. He's got a complete catalog the whole year of daily news stories from 1921. And I did a podcast about this earlier in the year, and I barely touched the surface. So, John, you are, what's the best way to describe it? You're doing a thing on Twitter this year where you're looking at the stories of the day for 1921, 100 years ago.
Yeah, you could see it as sort of like day-to-day coverage. Here's the news as it happened. Here's the political developments of the day, the congressional votes, wars overseas, disasters, sports scores, sort of like you're reading it from a daily paper, but with the, you know, perspective of 100 years back. So we'll also have famous people being born on this day, which obviously a reporter of the time wouldn't have access to, like Deborah Carr or Yves Montand, people like that, famous people born 100 years ago, this date.
Besides just being 100 years ago, it appears to be a very interesting year after World War I and then a recession and a kind of like struggling time.
You did focus on this. It's an amazingly probably little known thing from the time is how bad the economy was, because we think of roaring 20s, fun, jazz. And a lot of that's certainly true, because a lot of the commentary is these kids and how much fun they're having and how absurdly short these dresses are and these crazy jazz dances. But the economy is terrible. They're using the word depression. In fact, I was surprised to see it didn't quite have the same horrifying connotations.
Depression was intended to be a calmer term that if you look at a chart and you look at a line on a chart and it just slightly goes down, that's just a depression.
Right. And the word unemployment, though, that you will see a lot. And there's a real concern. This is not a hidden problem. In New York, there's stories almost every day about the unemployment problem, about people sleeping on park benches, people out of work, a very like a moral problem, because so many of them are veterans, people who fought in the war, who may have lost a leg or a limb. And they just can't get a job. And is this fair? People say, no, it's not fair. There was another little known fact, a war in Morocco where Spain lost something like 10,000 troops in a single battle to the Moroccans. And they were in desperate need of troops. They started to enlist people for the Spanish Foreign Legion. And outside the Spanish consulate in New York, hordes of people line up looking to enlist in the Spanish Foreign Legion so that they can get paid.
Wow, that's amazing. I had like no idea.
Yeah, there's like publicity stunts or like demonstrations for the unemployed. There's a character who seems to show up in the headlines every day, and now he's completely forgotten. His name was Urbain Ledoux, and he called himself Mr. Zero for reasons I'm really not sure about. But he, in Boston, held what he called a slave auction. He actually used that word, would auction people off because they were unemployed, auction them so that they could have a job. Someone would pay them, and they would take their shirts off and like just show that they were skinny but like able to work. They were like well-muscled. This like shocked the consciences of Boston, and he wanted to go to New York and repeat the stunt. And the New York authorities, plus the labor union, said, absolutely no way, no way. We will run you out of town if you try this.
You look at something like COBRA or unemployment insurance, Social Security, you know, and there can be debates about how much we spend, how long it goes for, of course. But not having them at all, you see what happened in the past. And I did one on President Doesn't Create Jobs, and I talked about the history of jobs being even a political issue, because in the 19th century, at least in the 20s, you're seeing they're talking about it. In the 19th century, it wasn't even something that a national politician would talk about.
You could say it almost veers into victim blaming at a certain point, because there's cartoons that sort of show like the ant and the grasshopper, like the worker who had a really good time of high wages and prosperity during the war, during World War One. Now times are scarce, but they've spent it all. So they're saying it's always the unemployed person's problem.
It is interesting, a little back in the napkin, that President Harding calls a national unemployment conference on August 28, 1921, with representatives from business and labor, and says that, and this is from the government, which means it probably could be more, over 5.7 million people are out without a job, according to the Labor Department. And you got about 108, I'm figuring, minimum 20% children, probably more at that time. So you were talking about more than 10% of the workforce unemployed, just back of the napkin.
Economists have also surveyed this time, and they found about that, what you said, 10%. You don't see any estimate about percentages in 1921. I guess, again, that didn't.
But the departments are starting. Herbert Hoover is the one in charge of the Commerce Department. He's starting some of this, even trying to calculate it at all.
He is. Yeah, give the guy credit, right? Mm-hmm. And a fascinating thing is he is that unemployment conference you mentioned. He's the man in charge of it. And a lot of what he's doing is like collating information, and he can maybe be forgiven for thinking that he was doing a great job during the Great Depression, because in 1921, or at least in later 1921, things did get better. We obviously did have prosperity in the 20s. In fact, I don't remember the exact quote, but earlier in 21, Herbert Hoover himself is quoted saying something to the effect of, "We're about to turn the corner." Which gives you like, what's the opposite of deja vu? It's like a preview of what he's about to say when he becomes president. Only in this case, he's validating.
So I noticed a story from August 27th, 1921, where arrest for drunkenness rose 34% in the first fiscal year since prohibition became law in the District of Columbia. An official warns that hair tonic, flavoring extracts, medicines, and the poisonous wood alcohol are being drunk more commonly.
It is amazing. Like, again, like people like probably still scratching their heads over just how did we get into prohibition anyway? It seems kind of insane. And in 1921, they know it, or at least the newspapers know it, because it is covered with this almost deadpan, you can't be serious that this is the law. One of my favorite accounts was how, someone was arrested at a, I don't know if it was a bar or a speakeasy or just a general nightclub where he was drinking. And, he was a noted, I guess, movie director of the time. Don't remember his name, but he and his friend are passing a bottle back and forth, basically as the prohibition agents are trying to figure out who to arrest because who's drinking the bottle. And these two guys are basically each volunteering to get arrested, doing like an Alphonse and Gaston effort, because they want to, someone wants to be, you know, the gentleman here. And finally, one of them allows himself to be arrested. And as he's escorted out, he is applauded by everybody in that club. And that just goes to show you that there is simply no public support for this. Another good one I'm just looking this up because it's going to be in October and we're not in October yet. But the World Series, by the way, this is also the very first year there's an all New York World Series. It's the Giants and the Yankees. We wouldn't call it a Subway Series because they were playing in the same park, the Polo Grounds. That game five or six, a squad of prohibition officers comes in, basically saying, well, we're here to enforce the prohibition laws to make sure the fans aren't sneaking in flasks or bottles. And the ticket takers say, no, you can't come in here unless you have a ticket. Your badge is not good enough. And they too have to, they get shown the door, and the fans just jeer and jeer and are laughing very hard. It is not a popular law.
Politics, see, it's seen as dry and wet. And the way politics would shape up, and you see several instances of this, would really be something more like dry, wet, mild. And you have figures like Coolidge. Yeah, I put Hoover there too, where it's like, well, we're not going to be into, you know, I'm not going to be a wet, but I'm also just going to keep this current level of enforcement that wink nod we all know isn't really working. Where there were some people who wanted to go, the, you know, the only reason that failed is that the enforcement wasn't good. I'm noticing again, you know, I just keep going back to August, but I think almost 1 month's enough, or maybe because it's hot in August, there's a lot going on. Soviet Russia relaxes its World War One era ban on 14% or stronger alcohol. So while U.S. is banning alcohol, the Bolsheviks are relaxing it, relaxing the ban, and the Bolsheviks had been puritanical in their attitude to drinking.
Yeah, a bit of a surprise for me to learn that too. I did not know they had such a bug about the thing. But yes, they did relax it, and I think they probably profited tremendously from it because they needed their economy to improve.
I would go all the way to the end of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was funded by excise taxes. The actual union government was funded by excise taxes and a few other things. And Gorbachev would disastrously try a prohibition crusade and actually sort of led to the, so that thing goes all the way to the end. I also note on this related thing here, and I guess we just kind of jump around because I don't know if we'll get to a top 10 fully, but some states have enacted smoking bans this year, but they're going against the tide as the tobacco industry gains clout and as a backlash forms against prohibition. North Dakota became the second state in March, the second state to forbid cigarette smoking in public places, banning the habit in restaurants and trains. Utah also enacted such a measure. But it goes along with this. Anti-tobacco laws are ridiculed even more than prohibition is.
They are. You could say they got their order mixed up as far as which is more dangerous. By the time prohibition has come, I don't think the American people have any kind of appetite for more prohibition.
Yeah, you see a lot of like, and this is so reminiscent of today, you see a lot of like people insulting it, like Reed Smoot, senator from Utah, says we're going to have a generation of dudes and nincompoops if smoking is banned. Now, maybe he was right. I don't know. Are we all dudes and nincompoops? And North Dakota actually repeals its ban under pressure from some of these kind of libertarian efforts in 1925.
Right. Those smoking bans certainly didn't go anywhere. Totally against the tide. And there's a few items from both, I think, the U.S. and from Europe that take note of women are smoking more. That is a pure marketing move by the tobacco companies to sell cigarettes to women. And the odd tone of the stories is they certainly don't think this is a good thing, because everyone kind of knows in the back of their head, even if they don't know exactly what it is about tobacco that can kill you, that it can kill you. But they know when they're talking about the fact that so many more cigarette sales are now going to women and that they're becoming customers, is that it's the women's fault that the idea of advertising as a phenomenon, as like a causing agent, isn't quite there.
But as part of your project, it's just amazing, by the way, reading some of the tweets and seeing some of those stories. We could kind of do a roll off of top 10 or just talk about a bunch of them.
If we were to draw our own top 10 list of the biggest things, it's going to definitely differ from what they would have seen in 1921. And I think maybe the best example of that is Tulsa. the race massacre mm-hmm. of Tulsa. Mm-hmm. We call it a race massacre because it was a race massacre in 1921. No, it's called a riot. And although it's a very big story, it makes front page headlines across the country, but then it's kind of forgotten about within 1 or 2 days and the country moves on. And now we think of it as sort of a defining moment of like post-World War I, racial hatred and just the extreme lengths the white establishment would go to keep black people in their place. It's just a horrific death toll. The official toll is 39. We now think it's probably in the hundreds, maybe the worst race violence in American history. And just reading the accounts, we kind of know if you paid attention during the anniversary about the toll, about the fact that so many lives were ended, property was destroyed, thriving community, it was known as Black Wall Street, was burned down, destroyed. But what's kind of like maybe even infuriating is the word is how much, to use the modern term, it's getting both sides. The coverage is, oh, it's so terrible what these white rioters did in this neighborhood. But, oh, it's so terrible how the black people started the whole thing.
Here's how the New York Times covers the Tulsa incident in 1921. Yeah, this is the New York Times. The bloody race riot at Tulsa began with a shot fired by a black person in an automobile at a police officer. It ended with the burning of the black quarter of town and the killing 15 black and 9 white men. Property loss is estimated at $1.5 million. Tulsa will have to pay heavily for hatred between the races and for the feebleness of its police force. So a really biased and inaccurate interpretation, everything from who started it to the death count, inaccurate interpretation of the events of Tulsa from the New York Times.
And when they're saying that the black people started it, what they're referring to is the fact that armed black men drove to a courthouse where a black prisoner was being kept and being threatened with lynching for something he didn't do, which was, an alleged sexual assault on a white woman that wasn't an assault and wasn't sexual.
I mean, it seems like the consensus seems to be he stepped on her foot in the elevator.
Yeah, basically tripped or got too close to her.
She didn't really pursue it much more than that.
Yeah, this girl totally did not pursue it. And what's more, not only was the lynching, the attempt at lynching, which was a mob of white people outside the courthouse in Tulsa, it wasn't successful. But not only that, the police never actually charged him with a thing. They let him go a few days or a few weeks later. Mm-hmm. And he's whatever happened to him in history is kind of lost. We don't know what became of him. I believe we don't even know what became of the girl in the elevator. We do know a lot about, the survivors of Tulsa itself, because we're still hearing testimony from them 100 years later.
I think you're right that we in 2021 would probably rank that first. Now, really, it's just been in the past few years that we talk a lot about it. And
it's hard also to separate it from how much extreme racial violence was going on at the time mm-hmm. that was, I guess, routinized almost. Now, almost every week there's a lynching, and I don't know the raw numbers. You could become jaded about that. I mean, they were covered. Just about every lynching is mentioned in the newspapers. They are a story, but they sort of follow the same pattern. And, sadly, it's like you can read these accounts and you realize just on the face of it, the guy they lynched isn't guilty of anything.
Why don't we jump into if you kind of have a top 10?
Sure. Well, I think it would be unfair to not mention Russia in 1921. Mm-hmm. From a world perspective, maybe this is the single greatest tragedy. I mean, it was an entirely a man-made famine. It was the new communist regime just essentially stealing the grain and the produce of their regions, of Russia's breadbasket in the Volga and region and other regions in southern Russia, starving the peasants. And at this time, they didn't actually set out to starve and kill peasants the way Stalin would, but just disastrously mismanaged everything.
Because they're pulling from the people making the grain to their favored people, which would have been like the Bolsheviks and the army, the political folks. Yeah,
exactly. And they had essentially almost deliberately sabotaged their own economy by declaring that there's no there's no money. There's everything's in kind, and just they turned the economy into chaos by that. So the result of this, and they should have seen it. It was coming, you know, for more than a year ahead with the peasants deciding not to plant grain. It was a big famine. That the death toll is still disputed. It's definitely well over a million people dead. Lenin has to bring in, basically has to get the United States to rescue him, or the United States and the West. They do so through a relief agency, the American Relief Administration, which is run by, here's our old friend again, Herbert Hoover, is the man who dispatches them and organizes the effort. He's a pretty big lifesaver. And again, this is a very big story in American papers. And they do have compassion for the Russians, but a lot of it is framed through, they were correct. This is a big disaster on the part of the communist government. But there's a lot of wishful thinking. Well, they're going to fall now. This is the end of it. A lot of speculation about what form the government after Lenin's going to, another czar, is it going to be a counter-revolutionary army or a white army? It's almost taken for granted he can't survive, but of course he does. This is, and I probably should mention the other big event in Russia, is the Kronstadt Rebellion, where basically a fortress, the whole Baltic fleet of the Soviet state, rebels and says, we don't recognize this Bolshevik government as real. We want a real workers' government, and we're going to support the workers of Petrograd, which is modern-day St. Petersburg. They fought just by declaring this and by proclaiming like a workers' uprising that Lenin was going to fall. Again, he looked pretty weak. The economy was complete shambles. It's a big country where revolutions like this are seeming to happen with some regularity. But of course, Lenin is a lot more bloody-minded than they are. He just absolutely crushes them. And that rebellion is over.
I think they were hoping for some foreign support. And I think they were hoping for workers to rebel in their name, you know, to take to the streets, and that didn't quite.
I don't think they wanted any foreign support, but that was a big talking point on Lenin and Trotsky's part, was that they are backed by the French. So I don't know why he picked on the French, but they basically made up a line that said the French and maybe some British are counter-revolutionaries supporting them. They did a lot of show trials where they would force people to confess to being counter-revolutionaries. And they weren't. They were actually like believing Marxists, who actually believed in the promises of land reform and worker control of the country.
That's all interesting. I noted in my other cast, I believe, in two interesting corollaries to this. One was that, so Lenin's brain gets examined in London, because they have a sculpturist who made a mold of his brain. And so they have a phrenologist examine him and find that he's got all kinds of problems. Surprise, surprise, you know. And then, it'll turn out to be somewhat real, because I believe his final act in 1921 is, and I hope it's not one of your top 10. I'm sorry again, but that is Lenin will ask for a vacation from the Politburo, and it will be eventually granted because he's under such stress.
I never knew this. I know that he does have a stroke very soon after this.
He's running the country. They're all looking to him for decisions, and the decisions aren't easy, including the one you mentioned, like to seek out international support, very controversial. There'll be a lot of politics around that. They'll start to like stigmatize even the people who are working with that American operation, and even though they'll take the grain, thank you very much. It's like you're also kind of like, well, we have to watch these people.
There's certainly that fear is present in the establishment, and the way the events of labor unions, strikes, and race relations are being covered is the Bolsheviks are behind it all. They're behind all the problems. They sort of shift the focus, where during World War One it was the Germans and Kaiserism is the enemy. They sort of mix the two, and then by 1921, it's decisively the Bolsheviks. In fact, there's an amazing Los Angeles Times story from just about 2 days after the Tulsa riots that, with a straight face, with basically no sourcing, just simply states as a fact that the Tulsa riots were caused by Bolsheviks. And again, no sourcing, but the idea behind it is, because of Bolshevism, black people have got the idea that they are the social equal of white, which that was a radical belief of the time, a belief in racial equality.
Certainly, 100 years ago. I did note that one of your stories in August that I had down there, W.E. Du Bois, has a conference and is an attempt to spread that idea, an attempt to really get the message out about world equality, and asks, the Second Pan-American Congress held in London issues a manifesto calling for absolute racial equality. They attempt to get Colonial Secretary Winston Churchill to attend, but his office politely declines. There are people there from Jamaica, Liberia, Sierra Leone, South Africa, Grenada, Gold Coast, British Guiana, and also from African Americans. And even though it's kind of easy to say, oh, it was a different time and nobody was thinking these things then, but there was a fight. There was a struggle.
There was.
This would have been a very radical position, but you see the ideas introduced.
For the British, an even more vivid example of this would be what's happening in India in 1921. This is, I think it's the year in which Gandhi first becomes a headline name. I found a Sunday pictorial feature on Gandhi that basically calls him just this a weird fakir who threatens who wants to revolutionize India. The picture of him isn't quite like the sweet holy man that we see now. He really was a revolutionary, and part of that idea is in fact racial equality. The Indians deserve to rule India, and I guess tragically, from a view 100 years back, is there seems to be at least among the if you call it native Indian leadership, a real also belief in religious equality, that Muslims and Hindus are united, a united front. Muslims are getting arrested along with Hindus for seeking independence, or at least seeking economic self-sufficiency in India. A very forgotten story, but not forgotten in India, is a very bloody rebellion that breaks out also in August. That's called the Mapala Rebellion, a people I'd never heard of before, the Mapala Muslims of the Arabian Sea coast, near where Kerala is. They launched a massive rebellion against British rule, basically ruled half of a province of India for a few months before the rebellion was crushed, and probably a very high death toll. Again, I'm not sure how much it would be, but sadly it was marked by very bloody sectarian warfare, where Muslims would massacre Hindus. Hindus would be forcibly converted. You know, a lot of messiness that went on there.
What else strikes you as a really good story of note?
I think we should probably talk about Fatty Arbuckle.
September 11th, 1921. Roscoe Arbuckle faces an inquiry on woman's death. The police announced today that they would take into custody Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, motion picture comedian, who arrived from Los Angeles today by automobile to clear up an affair at his suite in a hotel here last Monday, following which the death of Miss Virginia Rapp, a film actress, is said to have occurred. Arbuckle will be taken into custody by the police that has announced, pending an investigation into the woman's death. No charge will be placed against him, according to Michael Griffin, acting captain of the detectives, but he will be detained until after the inquest. Arbuckle arrived here by automobile this afternoon from Los Angeles to assist the authorities in clearing the mystery.
That is definitely the biggest, I guess, if there was such a thing as tabloid, that would be the big tabloid story of the day.
Yeah, Fatty Arbuckle is this really big film icon. He's got a $3 million contract, which at that time was an awful lot of money. We're still in the silent era of films. And I guess he and some young ladies, some other film people, go from Los Angeles up to San Francisco for...
Yes. And whatever happened there is hotly disputed, because, of course, it ends in a death and Fatty Arbuckle's freedom is at stake here.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The best way I think we can piece it together is that a lot of people got drunk. The actress in question, her name was Virginia Rapp. She may have drank too much. She probably had some sort of bladder condition and became very ill and upset during this party. She had to retire to a bedroom where she was like moaning, screaming in pain. Arbuckle may have been in the bedroom. That's disputed. A lot of stories changed from the witnesses. But the upshot of it is this party was once it became clear that Rapp was in bad shape, Arbuckle helped send her off to another room so that she could recover, got doctors for her. They really didn't know what was wrong with her, and she dies 5 days later of peritonitis. He is arrested very quickly for manslaughter, but it's not clear how he supposedly caused her death. There's one witness who brought Virginia Rapp to the party who insists that Arbuckle went into that room with Rapp. He says that she said something to the effect of, he did it.
She's hearing things out of the room.
And that he said something like, I've always wanted to be with you, or I've always wanted to do this, like very leering and villainous. But this turned out to be an extremely unreliable witness. She seemed to have like a record of blackmail or other unsavory. And the prosecution just could not use her as a witness in the upcoming trial. So a lot of the association he gets with maybe causing her death comes from this one witness. Most of the other witnesses saw nothing like that. But there is one very vivid bit of testimony which involves Arbuckle allegedly putting a piece of ice on her genitalia. That sounds pretty horrible. And it was so horrible sounding that newspapers couldn't print it. They would just refer to it as Arbuckle's torturing her with ice. But what apparently he did, or what the witnesses said he did, because we don't know what he said about it, was that he was using the ice on her belly and maybe on her lower region to relieve the pain as she was screaming.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly doesn't sound good in a newspaper in 1921. Whatever the court verdict was going to be, his career was doomed. His movies are canceled. All the showings are.
He's acquitted.
He is acquitted. I think he went through two different trials. There was a hung jury, second trial. Not only was he acquitted, but the jury made a speech declaring that he was a totally innocent man, that he'd been wronged, and that it was outrageous that the case should have gone forward. That's the consensus view of people who look back on it. Unfortunately, a lot of what happened in Arbuckle's defense was to smear Virginia Rapp, who, you know, was the victim here after all. Whether she was the victim of a crime, we don't really know. But she's often sort of portrayed as this may have tried to like sleep around to get ahead, that she...
It is interesting. I know you indicated too, and I really consider you must remember this to be the source on a lot of things, especially if we go Hollywood. And Karina Longworth does a great episode on this. So probably we'll refer you to a specialist audience on that one. But I do know that, you know, as a result of this, and she gets into it, as a result of this, Hollywood is slammed with special codes, with a special enforcement officer reviewing movies. And it really leads to a lot more restrictions on Hollywood. Yes. Because of this scandal.
A lot of this was probably going to happen anyway, because, again, things I didn't know until I started doing the project and reading the papers was film censorship was happening. It was happening on the local level. It was happening on the state level. And New York, of all places, New York created a film censorship board early 1921, and they would actually review all movies. They passed like the very first films, and then they objected without being clear on what they were objecting to. This was happening on a local level, like I said, and Hollywood basically had to do something. They couldn't just let their films get chopped up on such a basis. So they were going to probably do a internal censorship or a film czar, which is what they ended up creating, to straighten this whole situation out. Another interesting thing is I have access to a lot of British and Australian newspapers too, and the coverage is broadly similar. Only there, it's complicated with the fact that not only is the movies the way kids today are seeing movies, and they seem to show immorality and fast cars and women and exciting gangsters and crime. But there's also the cultural aspect that it's all American movies, and people in Australia at basically a variant of a PTA meeting in the summer of 1921 are complaining that this is basically cultural imperialism. It's all American. Where are the Australian movies? Where are the British movies?
That's an export of America that it's there, but we're not always aware of it. Is that we just run the entertainment for the world and always have since then. And, you know, a lot of people, this is an interesting side note, but why not? It's a lot of people will say, like, where'd the Kennedys get their money? And you can talk about bootlegging or whatever. There's really no evidence that the father was actually a bootlegger. And they make it in a couple of places. Well, if he wasn't a bootlegger, he was a stock pumper. So that's a big part of how he made his money, you know, selling stocks and then getting the price to drive up. And then the other is, you know, before it was all regulated, the Merchant Mart in Chicago, that big building, they were the owners and made a ton of money off that. And then selling movies to England. Kennedy was the importer of movies to Britain. And so that's a huge industry. And that's how the Kennedy family made a lot of their money, with that license to sell Hollywood to across the world. But yeah, we forget about it as an export.
Well, that's interesting you bring up Kennedy too. There's a little item in a Boston Globe, I think it's June or May, which is the birth of Eunice Kennedy. But it's reported because basically her mother's line that's more famous at the time. Joe Kennedy's not a famous person, but her grandfather, of course, is, yes, Honey Fitz, the former mayor of Boston. Very big personality.
Mass demonstrations in all parts of the United States, similar to those in European cities, to express indignation against the impending fate of Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzelli, the two Italian labor organizers whose murder appeal will be decided by the Appellate Court of Massachusetts on December 1st, are being planned by communists and other radical organizations. Announcement of the plan was made last night by the Workers' Defense Union, the Italian Committee for Defense of Political Prisoners, the American Labor Alliance, and other organizations after a conference, 201 West 13th Street, in New York City. The conference, which was called by the Labor Alliance, was said to have drafted plans for protest, equaling those in Paris, Rome, and other cities. This fight to save Sacco and Vanzetti is one of the most urgent tasks before the organized labor movement, said Art Shields at the Workers' Defense Union last night. This case not only puts American justice on trial, it represents a savage attack on the labor movement. It is significant that the newspapers crying for their execution say very little about the evidence against them, but harp on the fact that they were radicals. New York Times, October 31st, 1921.
And interesting, Massachusetts. I'll mention another one, because this was not. This doesn't quite become a huge national story, I think, until later in the 20s. But Sacco and Vanzetti's trial happens in 1921. It happens through, I think, June and July. It's a very long trial because it's so complicated what happened. I won't go through all the details, because even I'm not sure of all the details, but it involved two men, Italians, who rob a paymaster, shoot two guards dead, and get away with a lot of money. The police round up Sacco and Vanzetti because they're very well-known anarchists in this area of Massachusetts. And there's a very long trial because the evidence is super complicated. There's no direct evidence. There's no direct physical evidence, I believe, that connects them. There's some shaky witness testimony. But it does come down that they are guilty. And it is, in fact, protested. There are representatives from the ACLU at their trial who try to make a big stink out of it. But it's not overwhelming big national news yet, because I think what it takes is for the world to get involved, that socialist movements and labor movements and anarchists try to really publicize this case as an example of
Yeah, I mean, and certainly, yeah, we don't know. There's a lot of thought. Still don't really know whether maybe one of them did it and the other didn't. Maybe it was another gang operating in the area. A lot of things it could have been.
There was, I think, reading, and I'm not going to claim that I have read the transcript or know much, like all the details of the trial. They definitely went out of their way to tell the jury, we are not asking you to convict them because they are radical. That has nothing to do with this case. They didn't want to bring it up, but the judge in his instructions to the jury said something like, be good, loyal American soldiers, like you were fighting the Kaiser and do justice. Something odd like that. Like it was a metaphor that involved the pursuit of justice, not to be anti-radical, but it was certainly like an inflammatory statement that is a very strange thing coming out of a judge's mouth. I don't know how relevant this is, but it is just very fascinating to me. There was an incident in the trial, which was almost identical to the OJ, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit moment, which is when the prosecution asked Sacco to put on a cap because a cap was found at the scene of the crime, but they said this wasn't his, but they asked him to put it on and he kept trying to struggle to put it on. But a lot of it, I think, was very contrived, his effort to show that it didn't actually fit. And the jury noticed this.
Both those stories, Arbuckle and Sacco and Vanzetti, I was not able to get in the earlier episode. There was so much that happened in 1921. There was a death in 1921 that I found very interesting when I looked it up more, and that was Tony Jackson. And Tony Jackson is an American entertainer, pianist. He's African-American, based out of Chicago. He's originally from New Orleans. And he was not only gay, but openly gay, which you can imagine. Forget 1921. That's when he dies. His music career is from the 1890s forward. He's able to do this because he's mostly operating in Chicago and there's a little more freedom there. And he is in the music and entertainment field as a musician, entertaining in bars and clubs and the like. But he is the songwriter behind the song Pretty Baby. We don't have any recordings of Tony Jackson except with other people recording his music. And probably when I do this podcast, I'll have an example of the song Pretty Baby. But he was writing about another man, and you know, of course, none of the recordings that are done at the time portray it that way. But he dies in 1921 and is still extremely influential in jazz music circles.
Well, the word jazz you're going to see over and over again, and it's almost taken for granted in the headlines of the time that this is just a weird passing phenomenon, like some sort of Beatlemania in 1921. And one of my favorite articles I found is like the teachers' convention, which was, I guess, was actually not a teachers' union but a teachers' association that the state superintendent of education in California would call for the beginning of the school year. And he gives a very solemn address about how their responsibilities to teach, you know, civic duties to the kids. And then just almost in passing says like, this is going to spell the end of the jazz era. Like, again, taken for granted, this is something weird and mindless. Anything like close dancing is it's not only looked upon as something like objectionable, but it's actually banned in some cities. Like Syracuse actually passes a ban on jazz dances, which sounds very hard to enforce. And you can tell like the newspapers don't know quite what to make of it because they're just constantly using like whatever terms they hear to just mean basically close dancing. So like the toddle, the shimmy, they'll say something like the Chicago. I'm not even sure they know what they're talking about or if these were real dances. You see them over and over again. But on the other hand, it's also covered with like a very like amused tolerance. So you can tell like for all the horror that the educators and the moral reformers are greeting this, that it's clearly here to stay. I'll just mention one of my favorite examples of this, of the horror with which, you know, the civic leaders are seeing this is someone who explains to them that the shimmy, which is this sort of catch-all term for jazz dancing, was invented by the Incas in 1536 as a way to defeat the conquistadors. And it's not quite going to explain how that worked, but it definitely gave you like a negative feeling that this is a real societal evil.
Oh, there's one that I'm just pulling from 1 month, but August 3rd, 1921, sparks fly at a Capitol hearing about the Federal Reserve when former comptroller of the currency, John K. Williams, and a Fed governor accuse each other of lying. Fed chairman William P.G. Harding, they're not related to the president, charges across the committee room, swinging his fist. Order's restored and no one gets punched, but at the bottom of the dispute is the current depression. Williams had accused the Fed of lending at generous terms to New York bankers while imposing punishing rates on farmers and small businesses, and Fed officials calls him all but a demagogue.
This goes back to what we were talking about, the depression. The real difference in how you tackle a depression is seeing that the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates early in the year. The idea being, let's bring down prices, cut the, you know, increase the cost of money and get prices down, which, you know, it translates into workers getting their pay cut. It really is driving people to the brink in some cases.
And that John Williams would have been from a Democrat and the Federal Reserve were like Republican appointees. Like Williams, it looks like, was appointed by Wilson, comes from Virginia.
I'm not sure about the party affiliations, but in a lot of cases, these are you know, cross-partisan, because there's Democrats from the South who would be outraged about it, but there's also probably Republicans from rural areas who also want, like, more generous lending terms for farmers. Yeah, a monetary policy. It's depression era politics. And
I have a lot on that from the Arc of Commerce. We have the whole, we did one called Measure This, Measure Commerce. And it basically goes through all the measuring. And a lot of it is going to be this decade and the next where you get into this. Yeah.
I think in March, very quickly after Harding becomes president, Congress passes what they call the Emergency Immigration Act. And that, for the first time ever in U.S. history, puts a limit on immigration, and it's a very severe limit. It's 3% of all immigrants who had arrived in the country in 1910, and it's divided by nationality. So it would be only 3% of the number of, say, Italians, or only 3% of the number of Russians can come in. And this is like very broadly popular, mm-hmm. at least it seems to have got a lot of support in Congress. But first of all, it causes absolute chaos because the shipping lines, I didn't realize this either. The shipping lines, though, either didn't know about it or they started racing their ships to New York Harbor to get in, like, say, before the end of the month so that they could fill their monthly quota. And in some cases, like, the quota was for the year or for the month, and they were, like, getting filled, like, immediately. So people were having to be turned back or deported. And I guess this was eventually straightened out. I'm not sure how. I guess through, you know, sitting down with the shipping lines and making sure they understood the rules.
Yeah, I think that in times when there's a depression, we see this. It's like, well, we need more jobs, so limit immigration. And how effective it is, you know, I know that in the 30s, even Franklin Roosevelt was something of a, for immigration limits, except that he realized that you're going to need certain exceptions, like, for instance, the California Migrant Workers Program, which was accepted from some of those rules. But when the economy gets tight, people seem to do that same thing. It's like, let's tighten up.
Just like today, when we're just debating immigration, there's an economic side, but there's definitely people don't, I guess the people who are in favor of strong immigration controls would even say this, that there's definitely a cultural side, and that is disputed as to like, you know, how ugly or how racist that is. But there is that undercurrent. It's more than just an undercurrent. This belief that immigrants are dirty, that they bring disease, or and that they bring social revolution, that is all out there. That's all open. There was like there was episodes of typhus in early 1921 among people coming in on ships from Eastern Europe, especially from Poland and from Russia, where, again, a lot of this was caused by the disaster in Russia that we talked about earlier, the famine and the civil war. And during the debate over the immigration bill, this is brought up, and it's brought up not as a reason to help them, but as a reason to keep them out, that they're disease-ridden and that they're bringing disease to this country. There is the fact that it's the quotas are set at 1910 levels. There was talk about setting them even further back to about 1890, which is what happens later in the decade when they further restrict immigration and they set the quota levels at 1890 levels, which means a far lower percentage of Italians, Russians, Eastern Europeans are going to come into the country. Now, what they're obviously doing is they're trying to, you know, they're trying to set the demographics back so that we're a white Protestant country, and pretty explicitly. One fascinating thing I found around this time, around September, was a Rosh Hashanah sermon by a rabbi in New York who actually denounces this immigration quota law. And this is kind of a standout thing for him, because a lot of American Jews will keep quiet. They're here. They're safe. They don't want to make any waves. They're good Americans. But this rabbi says this is a shameful measure, and blood is on their hands because Jews are going to be massacred.
Yeah, I mean, these laws are still in place when we reach the crisis period of pre-World War II. Let's see. I think we probably have time for one more, but then we should probably close out.
What's probably the biggest story we left untouched? Let's see. The Ku Klux Klan it's not founded in 1921. It goes back to around 1915 in the movie The Birth of a Nation, which helps revive what they call the modern Klan. But I think 1921 it's probably the first year it starts making headlines on a daily basis, because there are secret Klan rallies. They don't get photographed much. You're not going to see many photographs of them, because at this point, they are in fact a secret order. But then I guess what happens is the Klan, which is based in Atlanta, starts to see this is a money-making opportunity. And they start forming chapters all across the country where, you know, membership dues, I guess something like $4 out of every $10 of membership dues goes right into the pocket of their publicity director. And it becomes something like a pyramid scheme where, you know, you can like enlist a member and get more money that way. But while all this is going on, I think there's just a general vigilantism, which we talked about sort of in the lynching episodes, but they don't always take the form of lynching. They can take the form of night riding, you know, people going in and sometimes expelling like entire minority communities. This seems to happen with a shocking regularity in Pennsylvania. There's an episode where a bunch of townspeople like drive out the entire Italian section of a town.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the 20s Klan is very much anti-Italian and anti-Catholic.
Yeah, but these aren't Klansmen. These are just the people of the town.
Yes,
they're doing
yes,
it openly
gotcha.
Without masks. In California, there's Japanese fruit growers, and they own their own farms. They sell their products, but they're selling it at a lower price than the white farmers are. The white farmers just gather together and expel them from their farms, kick them out. This becomes an international incident. And they have to back down because, of course, because that's interfering with the economy. This is happening to some Mexicans in Texas. It's happening to, it's happening to black people all over. In some cases, they're just wearing masks because they don't want to be identified. Oh, I have to tell you about this.
Sure.
This is pretty gruesome. They're probably Klansmen, but the stories never actually use the word Klan. They just call them masked men. And one of the things that the Ku Klux Klan was doing, they were enforcing, you know, morality. They would pick on someone who was known to be immoral. And often this was a white person who maybe had relations with black people, whether maybe he had a black girlfriend, maybe visited like a black roadhouse or a music hall or something, or was known to cheat on their wife, or maybe they would call a sexual deviant, and they would run them out of town, tar and feather them, or do sometimes more extreme. There's a fellow named McGee somewhere outside Houston who I guess was a, again, you have to read that it's reported very obliquely because these are to the 1921 very shocking details, but he apparently exposes himself to children on a playground. And he is taken out of town by masked men. And the report says he is reported to have been placed in the hands of a surgeon who is said to have rendered repetition of his offense impossible. So, yeah, we know what that means.
Yeah, I think you had this vigilanteism like Dallas. We talked about Houston there. I think Dallas, for instance, just controlled by the Klan during this period, but in a very quiet, well, that's the way they were, in a very like secretive way where the business community is totally behind it and even using it to their advantage or anybody else that would try to come in on their turf, so to speak.
Yeah, they would often, they seem to play a cute game sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like they would say, oh, I'm not with the Klan at all, but I support what they're doing. So that was a way of like not being, you know, you're not a member of a criminal organization.
You're going to have in 1924 at the Republican convention a few years later, you're going to have the VP candidate nearly picked by the Klan. Nearly picked, except that once it got out that the Klan had endorsed him, he had to protest. I don't want this endorsement. I don't want this. You're going to ruin me and everything like this. And then finally, the head of the Klan, who was there in Cleveland at the convention, not at the convention floor, but in a house on Euclid Avenue nearby, making all kinds of press statements. He's the one who eventually says, we don't have any endorsements. And then they go to Dawes. You know, you just have, yeah, this game that's played. I did want to, since it's so negative, I did have a positive one that I see August 26, 1921. Wesley Redding is promoted to be the first black detective in the history of the New York Police Department. He has been a patrolman at the West 135th Station for 18 months. So hopefully you see a little bit of.
There's some, yeah, there's some great stories you could say. There's, in early 1921, I think it's called the Theaters Guild of New York. They named the best actor of the year, and it's Charles Gilpin, a black actor who was the title role in The Emperor Jones, the Eugene O'Neill play. And this, this calls us something of a stir because that's kind of a remarkable thing. And there's even, you know, 1921 being 1921, there's talk, oh, will this be an integrated awards ceremony? Which it is. 1921, it's also the year Bessie Coleman becomes the first black woman pilot to have a license. She gets it in France because there's no pilot school in the U.S. that's willing to take her. And she comes back. Her arrival in the U.S. is actually noted, like, with newspaper stories that marvel that she's a real pilot, and she does barnstorming. Not only does barnstorming, but also like tries to teach young black kids about aviation. What starts out as a nice story takes an unfortunate like curve, which is President Harding, the new president. He nominates a black man to be the Register of the Treasury, St. Henry Johnson, as Register of the Treasury. He's like certainly perfectly well qualified. He has like, he's worked in Washington for, I guess, like 20 years in the Treasury. But this is now a new era because of the segregation of the office buildings that began under Wilson. The idea that, oh my God, a black man is going to work in the same office as white women. This is like the excuse that's used to actually derail his nomination. And he does not, in fact, get confirmed to the job. I'm not sure he even comes to a vote, but the nomination is withdrawn.
So at the same time, we were talking about the first black detective appointed. There is already on the force a woman detective in New York City, and she is featured in an article in 1921. She gets media coverage in 1921. That's Isabella Goodwin. She starts as a scrub woman, cleaning jail cells, supervising inmates. And as she says in an interview in the Brooklyn Eagle, she's able to turn it around. A woman joining the department, you know, had to take whatever job you could get and then finagle it into something else. but she becomes a useful in a role for dealing with any female crime victims, for sex crime cases, for doing certain undercover work. And she's very useful in solving a bank heist, and gets a lot of credit for that. She could pose as and expose as what she called fakers, fortune tellers, supposed healers, other swindlers that might prey on women. There is many a 6-foot detective with a gun on his hip who does less valuable work for his $3,300 a year than Miss Goodwin, said the New York Herald in 1921.
A Harvard student, and he broke the world record in the long jump. It's a guy named Edward Gordon. He was in July 1921, 25 feet 3 inches. And he did it at a kind of an unusual event that I didn't know existed. It was like Harvard combining with Yale to have a track meet against Oxford combined with Cambridge, in which the U.S. won. And Gordon, he actually goes on to become a lawyer in Massachusetts and a judge. And he's the first black judge on the Massachusetts Superior Court.
Oh, that's great. You know, one thing that I did mention on a cast, but it was only on the Patreon, that I think is really important for 1921, maybe a good way to end out. You have Einstein wins the Nobel Peace Prize for Physics. He doesn't get the award until 22, but this is the year he wins it.
Oh, yeah, and he makes his big U.S. visit in 1921.
His big visit, and his ideas are a relativity. He actually wins for an issue that's not relativity, because relativity is pretty controversial.
Something photoelectric effect, right? Which, I like relativity, I have no idea what it is.
Exactly. But relativity is a little controversial. But what I thought is interesting, and this was covered like in the Crucible book, is that so you have this relativity. There's, of course, just like today, a lot of attacks on it. And you have, of course, at this point, a kind of a nobody in Germany, Adolf Hitler, with one of the smaller parties, saying that this is just a conspiracy of the scientists, and of course, blaming Jewish people and saying that it's a psychological trap that they're putting on normal Germans to make them think the world isn't real, so that we'll never rise up as a country. And interestingly enough, it is the opposite with Benito Mussolini, who's getting a little farther at this time in his career in Italy and his path to become a dictator. And he sees it the opposite way, that something like relativity is freeing so that there can be a world of fascism because all things are relative. You know, both, of course, are misinterpreting what the theory is in 21.
There are scientists who, like, willfully misunderstand what it means. Like, you have, I think there was a fellow named Maxim. He was the brother of the scientist, the inventor Maxim, who invented the Maxim gun. And he got very mad that relativity was a thing, because he said, that's my idea. Because I said back in 1890 that everything is made out of atoms, so everything's basically the same. But there is something involving Einstein that definitely has to be mentioned. It might be my favorite anecdote, which was sometime in, I guess, April of 1921, Thomas Edison made huge news because it emerged that if anyone wanted to work for Edison's laboratory, they had to pass a test, which consisted of scientific and political and geographic questions that were devised by Edison himself. And they're sort of like a bad game of bar trivia. They were questions like, what's the percentage of magnetite in magnetite ore? And how many states border Kentucky? Or what is the population of Melbourne, Australia? And he said, these college kids today are stupid. They don't know anything, because they did so poorly on this test of his. And the newspapers went nuts with this. They were like doing stories about Edison tests for weeks afterward. A reporter, a wise ass reporter, comes to Einstein, who is visiting the United States at this time, and asks him, I guess what he calls an Edison test question, which is, what is the speed of sound? And he trips up the great Einstein. Einstein doesn't know. Einstein's response is a very forthright, I don't know. And then he explains, I'm not in the habit of memorizing such things. That's what I have books for.
Yeah, well, that goes to exactly that. We have been talking to John Blackwell. Now, check out his Twitter, This Day in 1921, at 100 Years Ago News, at 100 Years Ago News. You're going to get stories, and you can just go back forever on this Twitter feed and see very interesting stories that really say a lot about today's time. So, John, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Bruce. Love your podcast.
I want to thank John Blackwell for coming on today. And again, you can check out his Twitter, at 100 Years Ago News, at 100 Years Ago News, for John Blackwell's This Day in 1921. And yes, next year he's going to continue, he says, into 1922. I want to make a mention, though, of something that I learned. So John Blackwell is a listener of the program, and he was referred to My History Can Beat Up Your Politics by his friend Joshua Tanzer, who I recently followed on Twitter and was talking with. And it's just an example of how a program like this one, that's a little weird, just an odd-sounding name. I was told by the Columbia Journalism Review said, you know, the name doesn't do it justice. And, you know, maybe it's right. I look at it both ways. Some people look at the name and say, oh, that's kind of funny. Let me listen to this. And other people might be turned off by it. Who knows what's going on out there? But one thing I know is that podcasts, especially today with so many mega corporations getting into the podcasting field, podcasts need to be spread by word of mouth. And so I thought it was great that John actually started listening from a recommendation from Joshua. So, you know, take that lesson to heart. Is there someone that you know that likes history and politics that might benefit from My History Can Beat Up Your Politics? Let them know about it. All you have to do is find us on Apple Podcasts, if that's where you go, or Google, or CastBox, or Podcast Addict, Stitcher, whichever one you want to use. We've got such a large archive just on there now. There's over 400 episodes just on the what's free and available to you. So that's a great place. Otherwise, refer them to www.myhistory.com. canbeatupyourpolitics.com.